and domestic violence. How my negative social behaviors and attitudes impact the carbon footprint of individuals and their cities? Tonight, we'll hear some of her answers to those questions. To find out more about Urban Wilderness Project, you can visit www.urbanwildernessproject.org. And here is my interview with Jordan Keith. Well, I wanted to start and welcome you to Bread and Roses. If you can tell us a little bit what the Urban Wilderness Project is and why you founded this nonprofit about 10 years ago.
So I'll start with why I founded it 10 years ago. I had spent a great deal of time working with other organizations that on the outside, it looks like we have a very similar focus and we do very similar work. And those are great organizations in their right and the work that they do. But the challenge that continued to come up was their inability to reach into the communities that they were actually getting the funding to serve. Hmm. So, really trying to reach people who the Park Service had identified as people they wanted to engage as users, for example, and get them out into wilderness areas. And, you know, primarily that would be African-American people, Asian, Latino, and Native American people. But because most environmental organizations, certainly the larger ones, I would say, are still predominantly white and predominantly male, it makes that a challenge no matter what their intentions and their goals. There's remained a cultural difference that made it hard to engage young people or their families in letting their kids go away for extended periods, 21, 30 days into the woods where they wouldn't have access or talk to them in a situation that wasn't familiar. So after working hard and trying to overcome that barrier as an individual, I realized that really what was needed was a different type of organization with a different focus. And for me, also, the storytelling is a critical piece of it, not just the wilderness alone, because we carry a lot of, well, people, period, carry their history and their memories and their attitudes through stories. And so by using stories to engage people in their outdoor experiences, it is a way to magnify, yes, there are a lot of other peoples besides who you might see on a poster who might be predominantly white and male, who do love the outdoors or who have these amazing experiences. So that's where the organization came from, that desire to do that and link those two things from the beginning. And now it's been 10 years. It's actually a little over 10 years. I'm kind of in denial that we're headed to 11 already. And in celebration of that that growth and realizing what were the ways that we could move forward, the Urban Wilderness Project has actually is in the stage of morphing to three different organizations. Mm. And so in April of last year, we launched Urban Wilderness Works, which is the nonprofit arm of Urban Wilderness Project, to make sure that the programs of wilderness trips and the storytelling programs that we provide in low-income schools, that those stay free and accessible. Because for 10 years, Urban Wilderness Project has been under a fiscal sponsor, but really to move forward and grow in the ways that we would like to, and honestly move it from something that is only a passion that I'm working on, when there's so many other people that constantly wanted to be engaged, it really seemed that that was the best way to move it forward and to create a legacy for the organization, and still allow me, with Urban Wilderness Project, now having two separate focuses, to continue to develop the curriculum that distinguishes us from other organizations where we very much focus on the importance of people's culture and their history and engaging in the natural and the rest of the natural world to do so, and developing that curriculum so people can see the connection between environmental health and environmental justice issues when they're talking about experiences outdoors. So I'm really excited about that. So Urban Wilderness Works and Urban Wilderness Project are now in existence, and a wonderful group of primarily women that have come together to begin the brainstorming of creating the Urban and Wilderness Leadership Alliance, and that vision is to have a national collective that uplifts the work that women are doing in the community to move these types of environmental conversations forward, as well as other work that connects, and people may or may not see it at first glance, bringing those people together. And quite honestly, women often do not see how valuable their work is and allow themselves, I call it kind of to be a side dish,
mm-hmm.
when they're actually the main course at an event. They're the draw, and they're not necessarily billed as the main event. And so really to help uplift a group of women, primarily focused on women, people of color, uplift those people and work collectively to move our communities forward by teaching each other. So we're excited about that.
That's really exciting. I also think that very often women, we actually have developed, you know, some kind of solutions in order to address the issues in our communities, and very often that's also falling into the wayside.
Absolutely. People are very much working on solutions because for them it's not an issue that they're simply, you know, many people are simply reading about it and saying, oh, I'm going to assess it, but you're living it or you're seeing the complications and the nuances that play out in your daily life and in the lives of other people around you. So magnifying those solutions can actually, I believe, I don't want to say lead to the answers, but lead to a better way of doing things that we continue to do that we know are failing. You know, we do have success in the environmental movement, but there's something desperately wrong.
Yeah.
We all can look around and see that. We know that from the conditions of the air and the water and our public health. So perhaps another way than the way that we've been going is the best way to choose, or a better way to choose. And people who have those solutions to offer are often not in the forefront or given opportunities to guide policy. And that's really something I think is important.
Mm-hmm. And I think, again, as you explained when you shared why you started the Urban Wilderness Project, you know, your intention is really to look at the bigger picture. So, for example, you say that you believe that, quote, connecting to the natural world is critical to restoring communities, reducing domestic violence, building relationships, and acknowledging and healing historical injustices, end of quote. I was wondering if you could explain how that is possible, and maybe describe, you know, how is it that domestic violence, for example, is connected to disappearing green spaces and communities?
Absolutely. Well, I want to begin by saying and acknowledging that my work is an extension of the research that's come out of Dr. Frances Coe's work in Chicago, and her lab focuses on making those connections between land and humans.
Mm.
And one of the amazing things that came out, and I feel we would all be greatly served if we used her research in guiding public policy more, is that in Chicago, she used two public housing units that were identical as research requires. The difference between them was one that had green space, trees that were visible from the buildings, and another, identical, did not. And she focused on the work on assessing family violence with the women in the community. And I called her some years back and asked her where was the data on men. Mm-hmm. And there were not enough men to create the identical relationships in the two communities. So the violence, the family violence, is really focused on women and their children. And what came out of it that was amazing was the presence, the close proximity of green space. In other words, being able to see it out of your window changed people's coping skills. And that had been something that was established for healing in the medical community, that, you know, people who were ill in the hospital could look out and see green got better more quickly than the same patient in a different room where they couldn't see green. So there's precedent for the type of work, but she took it and discovered that it really impacted women and girls differently to see green out of their windows. And it played out in how their family violence reduced because they expressed going outside or coping with their stress differently than the people who didn't have access. When I read that, because I was working here in Seattle in an organization whose legacy has really made a difference, Communities Against Rape and Abuse, was focused on, you know, how do we dismantle violence in our communities. Mm. And because I lived in both worlds, the environmental world, working on one track, and people working to prevent domestic violence on another, I could see the connections clearly, and I joked that people from both camps would see me coming and say, oh, no, here's Jordan trying to get us to hug trees over here, the environmental. And the environmentalist's like, okay, here's Jordan again, and she keeps bringing up, you know, why we should go to other people's table. You know, we're always, as environmentalists, frequently saying, how can we get people engaged in our issues?
Mm-hmm.
And we want them to come to our events and to our table. And I say, take a look, for example, at this work and see how you can, Francis Coe's work, Dr. Coe's work, and see how you can come to other people's table. And so Urban Wilderness Project has hosted a series of community conversations, one of which is Green Spaces and Domestic Violence. And to bring people together from those two separate tables, if you will, to share a common time and conversation, and maybe create plans that could address the issues that both, you know, separate camps are concerned about. One of the ways that plays out, I see, is very much the focus, you know, in Seattle. And other parts of the country is very much focused on transit-oriented development, you know, and part of it is very much that we are going to create denser urban spaces and we'll be able to get quickly to these beautiful parks we're very blessed with in Seattle, for example. To get to those in proximity of your house, you can walk or drive or take a bus more quickly. The difference between them is the space actually being around your house.
Yeah.
And when you're doing urban planning and you focus on density, you lose the opportunity to have more green space around your house. That's the plan, but you will be able to get to these other beautiful spaces. I come from, born and raised in Philadelphia, where in many neighborhoods that's the case. There's not really any green space at all. And so for me, I don't want to see that repeated in places like Seattle and other places where there is some green space to preserve, because it's much more difficult to restore it. You're not probably going to tear up the concrete or asphalt and then go planting those trees. So that's very much the connection around it. And to engage women in understanding that, and it's law here, when there's a proposed land use action, that you might act and not just think that's something that doesn't concern you, because that land use action might actually change the way your community behaves. It might change how your ability to cope with stress allows you to deal with, you know, turning away from putting your hands on somebody, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And so magnifying that with a proposed land use action can really change who gets engaged to talk about, you know, that type of land use issue. So that's really the connection.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and thank you for bringing up, you know, and putting yourself on the line for bringing up these issues of, you know, the connections and the complexities of us as human beings and of, you know, us in interaction with the environment and, you know, how there's correlation in between who we are as human beings and our coping skills and what we are able to see on a daily basis.
Yeah, it absolutely matters. was once asked what was one of my favorite places in Seattle, and it's my living room where I'm sitting right now, because it's very, it's a backyard wildlife habitat. That's the little sign that I have out front to explain to the neighbors why the house looks kind of crazy around here. But we have, you know, trees that are growing. The plum trees, pink blossom against the gray sky. That helps me right now. I can look in my backyard. It looks pretty gray out there. Look at Daphne blooming, and there's evergreen. And I, you know, we have a, it's not a, you know, sprawling plot here in Seattle, but the presence of those things really matters to me more than how small my house is.
You just don't go through with it. You say you know the way to go, and I should follow. But all of your empty promises leave me hollow. And oh, how do I trust you? To me repeatedly, oh, how do I have faith?
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. And tonight I play with you an interview that I conducted earlier this week with Jordan Keith. And she is the founder and director of Urban Wilderness Project. And we talked about the work that she does to connect history, language, our environmental consciousness, and our social system. And I went on in the second part of the interview asking Jordan to share with us the mission, the vision of the Urban Wilderness Project. And here's what she said. I wanted at this time to look a little bit closer at the vision for the Urban Wilderness Project. And you have two very distinct aspects. And the first aspect of your vision, you say, your vision is, quote, to empower and mobilize individuals in their communities to remove the psychological, social, racial, gender, disabilities, and sexual orientation barriers associated with current land and water use attitudes, practices, and policies, end of quote. Can you explain to us what are the current land and water use attitude, practices, and policies, and how they are problematic?
Well, yes. So let's take a moment and step back and look at how wilderness is defined and by whom it's defined the way that it is, and how that understanding impacts land and therefore water use. So the very U.S. definition of wilderness is a pristine place that doesn't have people in it. And sometimes, and so certainly in our history, in order to create that definition, people who have inhabited those wild places, indigenous people in the U.S., native people, were removed from lands so that they could be designated as wilderness with that definition of wilderness, an absence of people in these pristine places. And that consciousness that wilderness has to be preserved as this separate thing comes from the history of the U.S., of growth, kind of when Europeans came and used a lot of the land's resources very quickly. Deforestation is a really simple and easy example.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, there were among those people, people who said, stop quickly, or it's all going to be gone. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just out of control, and there would be none of these places that we call wilderness today if those acts hadn't happened of preservation. So that's very, of course, a good thing that came out of a negative thing, of taking away so much. But at the same time, it's a very different cultural view that comes out of a very, very different practice of interacting with the land. And then here, and people often have asked, you know, people in the environmental movement have said, urban wilderness, what's that? Like, can you have wilderness in an urban environment? Because that doesn't fit with the definition of wilderness being a place that's absent from people, or where people are absent, rather, as opposed to a place where the ecosystem around you that you are a part of is allowed to thrive, where you're not eliminating everyone and everything that isn't you to manage the land. And so what comes out of that is, again, we're going to preserve these places that are outside of the city as pristine. We're going to do mitigation by removing a wetland here in your neighborhood and then preserving a wetland further out. Or we're going to build here and preserve farmland out. We're going to do a big exchange on that. Because wilderness or pristine places or those places you want to protect are far away. They're never right close to your home. Those are, you can build up. And so I find it to be problematic in a lot of ways because, well, let's just start with health impacts of that. I mean, while there is certainly a great deal of people that are moving towards the need for green infrastructure, green stormwater runoff infrastructure, for example, or mm-hmm. the value of a tree for carbon sequester, you know, to clean our air, which we learned as kids. We're trying to undo what's already been done when you change your habitat as a human so much that there's not the rest of the natural world around you. Mm-hmm. And that's what informs how we continue to develop, even though we fortunately are embracing a more holistic way of saying, well, how can we get energy? How can we slow down how much water is running off into our waterways, and that water carrying oil or pesticides or things like that? People are certainly addressing those things, but the magnitude of the change when you change the scape of an entire neighborhood or community, and you put hardscape around it, and even though we say, oh, we're creating permeable asphalt, for example, mm-hmm. because we're trying to emulate the soil, you have made what I feel are more permanent solutions for the temporary problem that you had of, we need more housing. So let's just go ahead and put it here as quickly as we can and build it up, and we'll do some, you know, eco-friendly landscaping around the building, and we'll put back some native plants, because that's really important. The changes that you've made outweigh that so much that it can't be recouped. And it's informed, I believe, very much by that attitude of the wild places, the places that are greener, the places that you go for solace and escape, those are outside of the city. Well, how does that work out if you can't get outside of the city? Mm-hmm. What if you don't have access mm-hmm. financially to a car, to the ability to go away? What mm-hmm. Where does that leave you? So that's why it's problematic to me, as opposed to what if we shifted that and saw the need to have urban wilderness?
What's very interesting is also, as you explained, the definition of wilderness and how it's absolutely disconnected from the people aspect. So how this is like from a cultural standpoint that does not even consider that we as human beings are actually part of wilderness.
Oh, absolutely. We do not consider ourselves. And in fact, that's where the racial aspect of the broader cultural definition comes into play. And that's a longer discussion, but if you just take a look at what was necessary to define people who live in the wilderness and still is, what language we use to describe people who live closely in the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, primitive, and what the history of that word is, not mm-hmm. only definition. So we mm-hmm. can't escape the history of those words.
So I wanted to stay on the language aspect a little bit more, because the second aspect of your vision is, quote, to provide programs and trainings which reveal, acknowledge, and address the global, historical, and persistent traumas associated with environmentalism as defined by dominant culture, end of quote. So can you talk a little bit more about, you know, the problems with the current way that we define and understand environmental stewardship?
Environment, so again, it's look at the language. So a steward has a high level of responsibility for whatever they're stewarding.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of land, that means that you are actively deciding how a piece of land is used, or water, or how those things connect. You're in charge. You're charged with the care of it. An environmental custodian is someone who doesn't have the opportunity to inform policy and make those decisions, but is out there doing very critical work of, for example, removing blackberries, removing ivy, planting things. And we call that stewardship because of, again, the connotations of custodian versus steward. My goal is to actually create environmental stewards who do understand policy issues as well as how those policy issues play out on the ground, and how, for example, we start with why is so much of the U.S. overrun with English ivy? How did it get here? When did it come? What else was happening in human history when English ivy was brought? Did the Europeans who brought it intend to wreak havoc on the natural ecosystem here? No, it's a beautiful plant. There's nothing wrong with it in itself, although we label it, for example, an invasive plant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're a steward, you must understand the cultural aspects of plants, how, why they were used. You must be able to make decisions about what's planted. If you're a custodian, you're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we train, and the reason, as I spoke about earlier, the reason for Urban Wilderness Project becoming three organizations that have a shared vision, is it really takes an intense amount of focus to develop the curriculum and train the individuals who need training and time to reflect as well in their own personal lives on how race, culture, and identity and language all inform land use practices. How they have historically, and that certainly is easy to map out in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly even in Seattle, where the Duwamish people, this has always been their home. The Duwamish people live widely in Seattle, but they're not recognized as a tribe by the U.S. government. And a lot of their stewardship practices, their actual stewardship practices of the land, are gone.
Mm.
We're not using those. So as a young person or an adult engaging in this, if you understand history, then you can look to the future. That's the principle it's the Sankofa principle. Sankofa is from West Africa, from Ghana. It's an Andrinka symbol, and it's a bird that looks back and a bird that looks forward. It's at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that principle, if you know where you were coming from, then you know where you're going. It says go back and fetch it. But the translation to us is is that. You have to know, you have to look back and look forward at the same time. And so that's what the trainings are designed to do, to help people have a historical understanding, but then to be able to see how they can apply that to undo and recreate the world that we'd like. Again, for me, language is important. We all say, many of us who do environmental work and our land storage, we say we're doing restoration work. And I challenge that word because I think it informs an attitude that lets us think we can destroy something and then just put it back the way it was. Yeah. And we cannot. And if you look at the definition of restoration in architecture, it is not that you have three bricks left from a building and you built it based on a picture and it's restoration work. That's called reconstruction. That's not restoration. Yet when we think about the land, and how it takes how long it takes 1 inch of soil to grow, 1 cubic inch of soil, it's like 10 years. And you think you're going to undo all of that and take 3 cubic inches of soil and rebuild an entire ecosystem. It's a system. So how about we let go of the attitude that we can restore something so that we feel that we can destroy it and then just build it back? If we say that we are not able to do that and acknowledge we could reconstruct it, is that really what we want? Do we want to reconstruct it, or might we decide to preserve it? Because if you think of that if you stretch that analogy to people, and you have a tree that is 80 years old, the work that tree does at 80 years old, what it knows and how it's interacted, cannot simply be replaced when you cut down that 80-year-old tree and then put in a 3-year-old or 5-year-old tree.
Mm-hmm.
Could you replace an 80-year-old person and the knowledge and wisdom that they bring to the world and how they connect and who they've battered to with a child to do the same work? No. So why do you think that you could do that with a tree? Because you think that you can restore. You can reconstruct. You can rebuild. You can create a new, healthy way of interacting that might exist. You can undo some harm, but the length of time to restore something is much greater than a single lifetime. So there's a vanity involved when you say you've done something and now it's restored. It might be at the beginning of a new life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's vanity, but there's also no accountability for what used to be there. So we don't acknowledge what used to be there. We're just going to, pretend that we're here doing good work and we didn't do bad work before.
Ding. And that's required if you are going to stay in a consciousness that does not want to acknowledge historical injustices.
Yeah.
You're willing to move out of that consciousness, then we can prevent future damage. That's where the Sankofa principle plays in. You have to acknowledge the historical injustices so you don't continue to repeat them in the future. What was there is gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering at this point if you could describe, maybe one or two of the programs that are available through the Urban Wilderness Project. You have a few of them. You have Griot Works, you have Griot Adventures, you have Wilderness Works, Restoration Works. Could you maybe pick one or two and tell us what do participants get exposed to in one of these programs?
Absolutely. So the Griot Works is, that's the West African word. It's a word for a storyteller. It's a keeper of culture and history. So, again, that plays into acknowledging your past so you can move into the future the way that you'd like. And that is very important for people, regardless and inclusive of their different ethnic and cultural heritages, especially when you have young people who are of European descent and they say, well, I'm a mutt. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, well, no, actually, you're something. And, you know, you might have a rich storytelling past. So how are we going to work? How are we going to work and bring those stories forward? And then take those stories, which the Griot Adventures does, is bring people outside to tell their stories, to experience places they might not otherwise have access to. And so that's a wonderful program, which in the last year we delivered in partnership with South Shore Middle School here in Seattle. A little shout out for them. And it was just a wonderful program, taking 75 kids in partnership with the Klondike National Park up to Mount Rainier to do incredible writing. And the Wilderness Works is a 17-day wilderness trip made accessible for young people who otherwise wouldn't have an opportunity to go. And we work with the National Park and North Cascades, building trails and learning about the importance of those trails and maintaining that area and the ecosystems around there. And then have a chance to enjoy the land that they've been helping to steward by going on a backpacking trip. So that's been the focus for that for high school students for the last 10 years. And last year, with the launching of Urban Wilderness Works, we also piloted a new program to focus on 18 to 24-year-olds, giving them that opportunity to go out into the wilderness and learn the job skills, the 21st century work skills that they need to survive. So we're really excited about that. And that's now all part of Urban Wilderness Works. Mm-hmm. And the restoration work program that you mentioned, and again, like I said, I've always had trouble with that word.
Yes.
How that trouble with the word shows up in the programs is that they're very much programs that dismantle the language. So under there you find, are you an endangered species? And the community conversations that we have, like the one I mentioned about green space and domestic violence, and trainings that help people look back and look forward in the work that we're doing. So that's what Urban Wilderness Project is focused on, developing those Are You an Endangered Species curriculum. Everything from, does homophobia have a carbon count, to strange fruit and the legacy of race, violence, and the environment, how that plays out when you're trying to get African-American kids out into the woods.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. And tonight I play an interview that I conducted earlier this week with Jordan Keith, the founder and director of Urban Wilderness Project, about the work that she does to connect history, language, our environmental consciousness, and our social system. I went on to ask Jordan, if she would share with us a few examples of how her work has had an impact on the youth that she works with. Here's Jordan Keith.
Examples of how your programs have made an impact, have changed the lives of some of the young participants.
Yes. It's hard to just pick one. I've been very fortunate to work closely with the participants from the very founding of the program and at the point when I was actually leading the wilderness trips. And, there's a young man who has been involved in the program from the very first trip. And his work as an artist, writing, he likes to write hip-hop and rap, and he is now a young father. To see the arc of his growth and his persistence and the accolades that he's given his young wife and his little kid about the wilderness trips and how those have helped him to keep his priorities and know what he values, that, in many ways, I can say that I've been honored. The one time he called me his wilderness mama. And that really actually means quite a bit to me, because it means that when he looks back on those experiences, which, believe me, are hard, 17 days, no, you're cooking, you're living in a tent, you're building trails, you're coming home and carrying your water, you are facing internal and external challenges, and he is among the other young people that have persevered through a lot of, you know, the challenges that come up in life. And one young woman who was also on the first trip, and again, they're still engaged with Urban Wilderness over the years. They've either come back as been staff or volunteers in the program over 10 years. So that's the kind of impact that we're talking about, a legacy impact in a young person's life. This young woman, she's, as many folks are, coming from Eritrea, and she said, "Oh, I'm gonna do what Jordan does. I'm gonna be an environmentalist." And her mom was like, "I thought you were gonna be a doctor." She says, "No, I'm gonna do that. They don't make any money." Mm-hmm. She has continued with both pursuits, you know, studying medicine, and then, you know, having incredible extended outdoor experiences in other programs. So that's the kind of impact that I'm talking about.
I was wondering if you can talk about also about one of your other initiatives that's called Are You an Endangered Species?
Mm-hmm.
And so the workshop that you have designed called that to help people really understand what they can do to protect our social but also natural ecosystems together.
So the initiative, well, the Are You an Endangered Species initiative is really, and the workshops really, slowing people down to take a look at what are the threats to your survival.
Mm-hmm.
And how might you lessen those threats, mitigate them, address them either on a personal level or social action level. And that workshop series was born out of the anti-Islamic sentiments that happened after post-September 11th. And here in Seattle, several people who were Sikh, not actually Muslim, were attacked. And I do say that I'm proud of Seattle because people realized that we needed to do much better about that. And when I was asked to create a way to engage high school students in environmental issues, who would probably, you know, see that as not, you know, see that as, oh, that's the thing that that's, you know, you always see white people doing that. That's what who's on the posters, so it's not for them. I thought, well, what is the connection? And if we, again, look at ourselves, because we are animals, and break it down, where do we get our food? Where do we get our water? What threatens us? And also look at how you have different laws to protect you in different parts of the state and depending who you are. The same way that different species are protected, different mammals or fish are protected in one corridor but not in another, or they're endangered in one corridor and not in another. Helping people to see the connection between an animal species that they might revere, enjoy, or adore, or be curious about what's happening to its world and its habitat, and seeing the similarities between your own, how your land might be threatened, or your water is threatened, or where you're getting it, might change. If you can see those kind of connections, then you have a person who is politically, socially, and environmentally aware, and realize that there is not a separation between social and natural ecosystems in terms of the outcomes based on people's, you know, choices and behavior. I think one of the single things to focus about is one focus in on is one that, you know, has been in the news a lot. And what does it mean, for example, if you are gay, lesbian, or trans, and you're protected in one state by its laws and you have certain rights, but then you move to another state and your protections and your rights are gone. So you went from being a protected, if you will, species, protected person to being unprotected, which happens with birds, which happens with fish. So understanding that it's not just as simple as who you are, but it also plays out in where you live, what are the attitudes, the social attitudes, and what's happening around you to the things that you depend on. You know, we often call, with the exception of Habitat for Humanity, we don't call our homes our habitat, but it's no different than an animal. We need the same things for survival. We need shelter, we need food, and we need water. And we need community, which other species also know and have. So that's really what all of the workshops focus on. We kind of start with that basic way of approaching seeing ourselves and seeing the rest of the natural world, and then move forward into different focused areas of interest.
Last week you gave a talk entitled Women and Whales of the Pacific Northwest, What They Have in Common. Was that part of the Are You an Endangered Species workshop?
It is. It's actually
okay.
A stronger focus. A wonderful volunteer that works with me, and we've been looking at how can we really move the women and whales conversation forward. And it's actually the part of Human Estuaries is actually the conversation.
Yes.
Look on the website. It's called Human Estuaries. And that's, again, like, let's take a look and see how much we have in common with something that we define ourselves as very much different from.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see ourselves as bodies of water when, in fact, we are bodies of water. The difference between our body of water is that it moves, and another body of water, with the exception of the water cycle, it's stationary. But, you know, we're 77% water at birth, and we're mostly water as we speak. And as migratory bodies of water, there's great benefits to that and consequences in what we put in our bodies, because what we put in comes out. And it comes out, and some of it can be treated and removed before it's put back into the water streams, and some of it cannot be. And so, again, making that connection between your human body of water, what you put in it, what you put on it, and that is going to leave your body, it becomes what I call the water web. And the reason I call it the water web is to distinguish it from the water cycle, that no matter what poster you look at, humans are not included in the water cycle. We are absolutely part of the water cycle. If you include surface runoff from streets as a demonstration of how things end up back in our waterways, how, again, have we become so disconnected that we don't understand that our excrement goes into the commode, the toilet, and is treated, and what cannot be removed because it was not designed. You know, wastewater treatment plants were not designed to remove the pharmaceuticals, for example, that go in our bodies and out of our bodies. Well, they don't just disappear. They go into the water. So now you're a fish taking ibuprofen.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, or maybe you're lucky if you're just fish on ibuprofen. You're a fish who's being saturated with endocrine disrupting chemicals that are in your shampoo and in your hand soap and in your, you know, the list goes on, in your personal care products.
Yes.
And we're connected to those things. And so what's happening to us is impacting what's happening to other species in those waters, for example. So the women and whales connection is, I call them the, they're our canary in the coal mine. What's happening to the orca whales in the Pacific Northwest and our pods here who are on the endangered species list? There's, I think it's 83, maybe 84. I can't remember if another calf was born. Well, they are able, you know, they're one of the most studied pods species that there are. They've been studied for a long time and paying attention to them. And you see how the changes are happening in those orca families, and they are families. They live like we do. That mammal species is, to me, so much like us, or we are so much like them. They live in a family. They live in extended families. They stay together for a long time. I've never seen a whale breastfeed, but can you imagine that? Mm. You know, they breastfeed, and so much as we have come to have concerns about chemicals that are entering our body and exiting through breast milk, it's happening with them as well. And with them, the whales, the orcas, they are able to tell you how long these effects will last, how many generations. Epigenetics, the generations that will be impacted by the chemicals that they don't have, you know, they don't have a say in whether they're being exposed to them or not. We do, in some ways. Certainly not as enough, because there's not enough consumer protection around that, but to help people begin to see those connections again, magnify how beautiful the connections are between the natural world and that we are also nature.
Yes. Yes, therefore our faiths are also intertwined.
Absolutely. Our faiths, and most unfortunately, you know, just like they did, they used to send the canary in the coal mine to say whether you were going to go in there. If it didn't come back, if it died, you shouldn't go in. Well, I mean, I cannot imagine a world without our southern pod of orcas. But they're dwindling. There's, you know, if you put 81 people in a room, 84, let's go crazy and say 90, 400, and would that be enough? Would you be okay with that? That's how many the orcas there are. And we can look at what's happening to them. Why the younger orca whales are not living as long as the grandmother. Why the male orca whales have a higher chemical load than the females. Because the females are offloading it into their offspring. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happening. We can make the correlations and see what's happening in human health. But because those are considered two separate disciplines, two different camps of thought, the conversations are not had simultaneously so that you can examine the connections. And I feel like that's important, and I get to do that with the Are You an Endangered Species curriculum and workshop. Mm-hmm. Let's look at these things side by side and instead of separately, because I think that future generations have the answer that we need, and they deserve an opportunity to, I don't know, to try.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and we're wrapping up here. I just played with you an interview with Jordan Keith, founder and director of the Urban Wilderness Project. Please go and check out their website, urbanwildernessproject.org, and go check out, there's a TED Talk about human estuaries, about being bodies of water. I really encourage you. And if you are looking for something to do on Sunday, well, Belinda Underwood has a CD release party. It's called Green Girls Show, and it's an evening of womanifestation of a better world through song, showcasing Alexa Wiley and Cassandra Robertson. And Belinda Underwood will be on Bread and Roses in May, so go listen to her music. This is Marvin Gaye. Have a wonderful week.
Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be lost. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. All things ain't what they used to be.
This is Jamila from Guess Who's Coming to Radio. As you may know, the show has taken a hiatus from being on the air. While I will still be involved in radio, I'm here to welcome the ones who will be there on Thursdays, doing radio, which is positive, aware, and proactive. I thank you all for your support and positive words and energy. And just know that it means a lot to me. Wherever you are, stay focused and keep listening to KBOO, your community radio.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.fm under Community Events.
Hey, this is Danny Glover, and you tuned in right here to Hard Knock Radio. Let's get it on.
What's up, y'all? This ain't your boy. This is your brother, Ice Light. And you're tuned in to Hard Knock Radio. Yep, peace.
If the healthcare system is in fact violating the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment, and Ms. Major spoke briefly about the experiences of transgender women in prison, then imagine that their experiences are tenfold of what other women are experiencing. Laverne Cox plays Sophia Bursette on the adaptation of Orange is the New Black for Netflix, and her experience is that she is inside of a prison that matches her current gender identity, which is not true for Ms. Major, and which is not true for many transgender folks. And for those of you who don't know what being transgender means, it essentially means that your gender identity is different from the sex that you were assigned at birth, and Ms. Major can elaborate on that a little more if she likes. And so we're going to talk a little bit right now about family and love and how prison tries to break down connections between people. You know, we know family is a fundamental human right that prisons deny people through outrageous phone costs. And just to let folks know, I spoke to the folks at Center for Media Justice and Nation Inside just before this panel. And on February 11th, after a very long battle, the FCC agreed to lower the phone rates for prisoners and their families to 21 cents a minute for debit calls and 25 cents a minute for collect calls, whereas before you could spend $17 for a 15-minute call. Very egregious, but we are making some headway on that thanks to their really hard work, and the Nation Inside is also committed to working on that. And so if you or somebody you know is in prison and making calls and they are still charging exorbitant rates, please let them know and I can give you their information after. But for the panelists, we'd like to know, how have you seen or experienced prison's impact on the fundamental right to family? And that family means however you determine family to be, not the social construct that we've determined that families look like in this country, but family chosen or biological.
They have this way that you can take these hormonal shots to let everybody know in this type of environment that you are a transgender. And me personally, I don't feel like I need to take the shots. I made a joke about it to my best friend, and I told him I already grow face hairs, and I already look like a male anyway, and my heart says this is who I am, and I identify with it. But the lines and the way that they look at everything in this place is real, real small. And so if I don't want to go into the category of want to take these hormonal shots, then they don't recognize who I am as a person.
I male identify. And in this prison, from the prison administration, it's really looked down upon. Unfortunately, no matter what kind of programs I participate in or how much I personally grow, the reality is I'll never fit the image of what a rehabilitated person should look like leaving this facility because I don't express myself in a feminine way.
And I feel like they're trying to keep me in prison within myself. And well, it's a pretty big issue here. I don't even get to attend any type of groups with anybody that's transgender or are trying to do any type of work on themselves in that type of environment. I just kind of do my own thing and I self-educate myself.
Through hard work of Justice Now and other organizations that care about us so much, CDCR has changed policies to address transgender issues. And just recently, the CCWF has adopted a transgender program, and we can actually receive a hormone replacement therapy. Unfortunately, this DOM supplement that allows this is very, very black and white, and it leaves out a very huge segment of our population who male identify but just choose not to have hormone replacement therapy. And those people are excluded from group therapy and individual therapies and other benefits that these programs give us.
One of the things that they tend to not talk about, if you don't fit in the crowd, is either you are a feminine girl running around here or you are transgender. And since I don't have no paperwork that says that I am a transgender or that I male identify, then I'm just a person here. And so I would like for everyone out there to know that it's crazy how society is moving along and things, and the world is making itself better and accepting people the way they are, but in this place it's like we're going backwards.
Just recently, CDCR has distributed our new property matrices. Our property matrix lists all the items that we're allowed to have or not have.